The feds roll out new worker heat protections. South Florida cities respond to new restrictions on the homeless. And Little Haiti's Cultural Center sees new controversy. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine new federal rules that preempt a Florida state law that preempts local government laws to protect outdoor workers from extreme heat. Given the new temperature norms we face, the stakes are high. We'll also look at how local governments here are scrambling to adapt to a new state law that bans the homeless, with U.S. Supreme Court approval, from sleeping in public spaces. And we'll assess the future of Little Haiti's marquee institution. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Last week, a new Florida state law took effect that bars local governments from mandating heat protections for outdoor workers. The statute was written largely in response to controversy surrounding an ultimately failed effort to pass a heat protection ordinance in Miami-Dade County this past year. But a day after the Florida preemption law went live, the Biden administration laid down new rules preempting the state's preemption. So worker heat protections now may have an overriding federal mandate. This heat hullabaloo brings high stakes, especially here in South Florida, where so much work is done outdoors all year round, from agriculture to construction to tourism. Workers argue our global warming realities and off-the-chart heat indexes, which we're feeling again this summer, make stronger heat safeguards necessary, and they point to recent on-the-job deaths here as proof. Businesses insist they already have protections in place, and they say the new rules are an unnecessary economic burden. Do you think outdoor workers here need more heat protections? Do you work outside? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Summer Brugal, Miami reporter for the news website Axios, who's been closely following this regulatory battle. Summer, thanks for coming on. Summer, you there? Muted? I think you're muted, Summer.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
No, thanks again. Summer, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of this came about because the Miami-Dade County Commission, starting during last year's god-awful heat wave here, attempted to craft and pass an ordinance mandating heat protections for outdoor workers, and it was, if I remember correctly, going to be the first of its kind in the nation. Remind us, please, Summer, what that ordinance would have included.
Sure. Yeah, at the time, around this time last year, it was introduced that the agriculture and construction industries would have to provide things like water, rest breaks, and shade for their outdoor workers, or face a financial penalty. And those rules would kick in if the heat index had, you know, surpassed 90 degrees. And that, at the time, there was no law in place, no state mandatory law kind of requiring those things. And so that was the initial rule that was proposed.
Nor any in the nation, was my understanding, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a lot of backing for the Miami-Dade ordinance, especially after a migrant farm worker here, Efrain Lopez Garcia, died of heat stroke on the job. Here's one demonstration last year at the Miami-Dade County Government Building in support of that measure.
¿Qué queremos?
¡Agua, hombre, descanso!
¿Qué queremos?
¡Agua, hombre, descanso!
They were demanding agua, sombra, y descanso, or water, shade, and rest. But there was just as much resistance to this ordinance from the local business community, correct? What happens, Summer?
Yeah, so the measure that was introduced locally, it did pass, you know, upon that first introduction back in September, and then there was really that pushback from local businesses, and the pushback really kind of boiled down to, you mentioned earlier, this, what critics said was, you know, unnecessary regulation,
right,
and overreach from local governments on things that they were already doing. And that kind of, you know, what that that's what the pushback really kind of boiled down to was this, you know, overreach from local
Right.
governments.
And there was also a complaint that it only focused on the agriculture and construction industries.
Correct. It kind of singled out these two industries.
Why just us? So then, enter Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and the Republican-controlled state legislature. What exactly did the law they enacted this year prohibit in the wake of the Miami-Dade ordinance drama?
Yeah, essentially, you know, that, you know, the statewide measure that's, you know, DeSantis signed into law essentially just blocked the efforts from Miami-Dade and any other local government from mandating or enacting those things that they were calling for locally, like watershed arrest. So it really just kind of ended any of those efforts.
Right. And we should point out the Miami-Dade ordinance effort just sort of died on the vine then recently, right?
Correct. I believe it was back in March, but around that time.
But there seems to be some confusion about the new law regarding just who it applies to. I'm talking about the new state law. Does it only apply to government workers and not private sector workers? Help us clarify that, please, Summer, if you could.
Yeah. So the Florida law really does it prevents. Or a mandate, the mandate only applies to local governments. So companies, private companies could really enact these rules. And, you know, I did speak to a couple of individuals here locally, you know, from WeCount and other groups that are advocating for these and have been advocating for these measures. You know, they're really pushing that that this law doesn't remove the responsibility from these local business owners or from these private business owners to offer these protections. And they're, you know, the local advocates are still pushing for those businesses to do so.
Okay. So now enter the Biden administration and the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. As I mentioned, a day after the state law banning heat protection mandates goes into effect last week, OSHA proposes rules to ensure that outdoor workers are guaranteed those protections nationwide. And it would be the first of its kind federal effort in this regard. What exactly would the new federal mandate be if this is approved? What are its specific heat production, or excuse me, protection guidelines? How would it work?
Yeah, so there's kind of a lot of different things under the proposed rules, but you know, some notable ones are, you know, employers of certain jobs would have to establish, you know, a heat safety coordinator for the workplace and really mm-hmm. develop procedures for responding to symptoms of heat illness. Mm-hmm. Those plans would need to be evaluated annually. They also would require employers to monitor heat levels for outdoor workers. And one thing that's notable is the rule would apply to both indoor and outdoor workers who do engage in physical activity,
right.
And are exposed to heat when the heat index is above 80 degrees,
right.
Which is notable given that Miami's was 90. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't cover people. One thing that I want to point out is that doesn't cover people who take short trips outside or emergency responders or teleworkers.
Right. Now, Summer, do you think the Biden administration was acting in response to the new Florida law when it proposed this new rule?
You know, I can't speak for the Biden administration, but, you know, OSHA had been working on regulations for some time. But there really was, I think it's safe to say that there was a lot of chatter, I guess, if you will, around Miami-Dade and what was happening in Florida. But again, I can't speak to what the Biden administration did or what motivated them. But it's definitely safe to say that Miami and Florida's bill definitely kind of got some eyeballs.
And how many workers here and around the country could this new federal rule affect?
Federally, around the country, it could affect about 36 million workers. Here in Florida, that number is obviously a little smaller, but mm-hmm. it would still impact about 2 million outdoor workers across Florida.
Wow.
And around or more than 300,000 here in Miami-Dade.
Mm-hmm. And just quickly, what are some of the more important statistics backing up this action in terms of how many heat-related illnesses and deaths we've seen in the workplace in recent years?
Yeah, according to, you know, some of just the latest data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there were between 2011 and 2020, there were 33,000 or more than 33,000 work-related heat injuries and illnesses, and that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I think it's also important to note that more than 75% of heat-related fatalities occur during that first week on the job. So it really is the majority in that initial onset of when they do begin working
When you're
outdoors.
really not used to it yet. Yeah,
Correct.
when you're most vulnerable. We've got Lee on the line from South Miami, and he is a retired lifeguard who knows the need for heat protection, obviously. Lee, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. There's a whole lot that could be said about this. I'm real glad you're having the show. Obviously, people need access to water. The fact that we're even having to write legislation about it is pretty tragic, in my opinion, almost criminal. But city government, I worked for the city of Miami Beach for 35 years as a lifeguard, and we didn't have to have that kind of mandate because we had access to shade and we had access to water.
Right.
So this doesn't apply to me, but farm workers, lawn people, of course, they need access to. I can't even imagine that they don't have
Right. So
access and time.
what you're just saying, Lee, is this ought to be common sense, particularly now. So thanks for your call, Lee.
Right.
We appreciate it. So Summer, where do would things stand then in places like South Florida if the new federal rules go into effect? Will it render the new state law null and void, for example? And if that's the case, will there even be any need anymore for local ordinances like the one Miami-Dade considered? Or could local governments like Miami-Dade even enact heat protection ordinances that are tougher than the federal rules? I mean, what are all the possibilities now?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of possibilities. It might be too soon to say exactly how, federal law would impact South Florida. These rules were just presented earlier this month. They're still, they could change. They could, shift slightly, and they still need to be passed. And I do think it's notable that these rules will likely be challenged by a lot of the same organizations or industries that, challenge them locally.
Right.
So I think it might be a little too soon to say how exactly they would impact, workers on the ground here in Miami-Dade. But, on the ground, I've talked to, organizations that are continuing those education efforts for workers, how to look out for heat, symptoms related to heat illness. So I think those efforts will continue. And like I said, it might be just a little too soon to say how a federal rule would impact
Right.
workers
It
here.
makes sense. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Summer Brugal of Axios about the federal, state, and local battle over heat protections for outdoor workers. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Summer, let's look at the larger phenomenon here that's driving all this, which is, of course, the abnormal heat, or perhaps I should say, unfortunately, the new normal heat that we're experiencing today because of climate change. Is the new federal move on heat protections for outdoor workers just an inevitable consequence of global warming that, frankly, businesses should not be that surprised about?
I do think it is kind of it's been reported that human-caused climate change is making the heat waves more likely and more intense and longer lasting. And I think like you said, last summer was incredibly hot summer. We've already experienced the hottest May on record here in Miami. And I don't think that that is going to change anytime soon.
Right. And another big stat is that last summer in South Florida, we had 46 consecutive days when the heat index was above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Yes, exactly. So I don't know if the federal move is, an inevitable consequence of that, but I think, workers or not workers, but advocate groups here in Miami-Dade and elsewhere have been pushing for these, regulations for quite some time, not just in the last, year or two where we've seen these extreme heat waves. So I think that this has been, something that local groups and others have been pushing for quite some time. And these new heat, I like you said, normals, I guess, kind of really give a new backbone to the fight, I guess.
But what about the claim that businesses made here during the Miami-Dade ordinance debate that they already had common sense extreme heat safeguards for their workers in place, and that local ordinances and federal regulations are both unnecessary and too costly, as we mentioned earlier? I spoke yesterday, for example, with Costa Farms here in Miami-Dade, which was one of the most vocal businesses against the Miami-Dade ordinance, and they insist that they've long had heat protections in place. But even so, should businesses just accept the fact that given the climate circumstances we face now, they'll just have to accept this sort of oversight the way, say, factories have had to accept safety standards like these for decades?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair question. I think it might be, again, just we don't know how these, you know, federal rules are going to play out. So I'm not sure how, if it's if it'd be good to say what businesses should or shouldn't accept at this moment. But again, I'll go back to the fact that local organizations have been pushing for this. And while they do acknowledge that, you know, businesses, some do put these, you know, regulations in place and protections for their workers, not all do, or not all do to the point in which advocacy groups say that they should be doing it.
And
so I think that that's kind of what we'll see moving forward.
And just real quickly, Summer, when they say that this is a cost burden, what do they point to as being the costliest aspects of these kind of regulations? Like, for example, having a heat safety coordinator on site. Are those the kinds of things they point to?
Yeah, I think something like that. Also, you know, at you know, local government levels, having, you know, perhaps an office to enforce these measures could be costly as well, or we're unsure of how much that would cost. So I think, you know, anything of that nature could be something that they would be pointing to when they reference cost.
We also have Tony from Delray Beach on the line. He thinks that policymakers should spend a day on the job outdoors themselves. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup, Tony. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, you know, I think this is, to me, it just signals a pathetic disconnect between the folks in the ivory tower that make the rules and regulations and the folks that actually have to carry the burden. I mean, seriously, if most of these folks had to spend a week on the job just to understand what these regulations are all about, they would probably be back in the office after 2 hours. Heat exhaustion, trying to figure out how to get everybody else on board. Right? Like, seriously, right?
Yeah, Tony, do you yourself work outdoors?
No, you know, I don't. I've through school, I work construction and landscaping, and I know how it is, right? And that was a long time ago. And
right.
The type of heat that we have here, I mean, it's just, I mean, like, what's humane? Like, really?
Right.
It's just another disconnect, you know, those that, well, you know, do as I say, not as I do, Jonathan, but, you know, to
well,
me anyway.
Well, thanks for your very good point, Tony. We appreciate it. Finally, Summer, I just wanted to ask you here. We are actually seeing some federal OSHA action now, right? The agency is citing an agricultural contractor out in Arcadia, Florida, for not protecting an orange harvest worker who collapsed and died in the heat last year.
Yeah, that's right. That notice went out late last month in June, and the OSHA is saying that that contractor failed to protect a worker who collapsed while harvesting oranges last year. And according to that report, the heat illness occurred on a day where the heat index reached 92 degrees.
All right. So we're going to be seeing, I think, a lot more of this. This kind of thing. Summer Brugal is the Miami reporter for Axios. Many thanks. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Yesterday, the Miami City Commission unanimously passed an update to its ordinance that bans homeless encampments on public property. Homeless persons now may not use bed mattresses or bedrolls in public spaces. Police no longer have to give those persons 2 hours to gather their belongings and clear out. They only have to give them, quote, reasonable time. Up in Broward, city officials from Fort Lauderdale to Lauderdale Lakes are scrambling to figure out revisions to their own rules on the homeless population. What's sparking all this local activity is a new state law that goes into effect October 1st that prohibits homeless persons from sleeping in public spaces. It's a statute that just got a green light from the U.S. Supreme Court, which 2 weeks ago ruled it is constitutional to arrest or fine homeless persons if they sleep in public spaces. Now local governments like Miami are trying to thread the needle, how to comply with the new mandate while still bringing a measure of compassion to the growing ranks of homeless persons in our midst. What do you think is the best response? Have you experienced homelessness? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss this, we would hope to have Miami City Commissioner. Oh, okay, he's coming on. Miami City Commissioner Manolo Reyes, who represents District 4, and Rebecca McGuire. She is Broward County's Strategic Housing and Innovation Officer. And if we can get Commissioner Reyes, that's great. If not, we also have with us WLRN investigative reporter Danny Rivero, who follows this issue very closely here for us. I want to thank you all for coming on to talking with us.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, and but we do have also Rebecca McGuire with us as well as Danny. So let's get started here, Danny. Let's for context with people. Let's hearken back to 1988. When the city of Miami agreed to a lawsuit settlement known as the Pottinger Agreement that effectively prohibited the police from stopping homeless people from doing things like sleeping in public. A few years ago, Miami moved to abolish the Pottinger Agreement, arguing that it was out of date and no longer necessary. So to help our listeners understand where things stand today regarding Miami's rules for homeless people, remind us what then happened and where things stand today.
Right. Well, the Pottinger Agreement was really a landmark agreement between the ACLU and different groups in the city of Miami. And essentially, it stood for decades as something that is actually taught in law schools across the country as yeah. An example of the kind of agreements that can be reached with municipal governments. But essentially, it forbade the city from making arrests for people simply for doing life-sustaining activity. Like, if you have to sleep in public because there is nowhere that you have to sleep, you cannot be arrested.
If there are no alternatives, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They could not arrest you for it. Or if you are homeless and there's no alternative and you have to, urinate in the bushes somewhere under a bridge or something, they can't arrest you for it because there is essentially no option. So that was in effect for decades. And in 2019, the city went to federal court, to the judge that was overseeing the agreement, and said, hey, we've made all this reduction in homelessness. We have all these programs in place and whatnot. Please get us out from under this decree. We're going to follow the spirit of it anyways, but get us out from under federal oversight. And they agreed to it. And then,
And so then we come to this new ordinance then passed then that essentially allows now police to go back to being able to arrest.
Right.
Homeless persons, if they're sleeping, or at least tell them that they've got 2 hours to clear out.
Right, and very shortly after that agreement was ended, the police started doing sweeps of homeless camps and clearing out, and some of it they say was for sanitary issues, and it is understandable on some level, but it was a total 180 from where things were before that.
So Commissioner Manolo Reyes, again, thanks for being with us. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Okay.
And
thank you for the invitation.
So, Commissioner, then we've sort of brought us up to date here. What then did you and the City Commission essentially update yesterday in terms of this ordinance regarding the homeless population?
But basically, what we did is we got in a that state did pass a law.
Yes.
And what we did is we just accepted that law and the City of Miami, because the state is the one that is above us.
Right.
So that's the only thing that we did. It was the same requirements that the state placed on as a law. We accepted it. But that's not the only thing that we're doing, you see. We've been working very hard and with the different organizations. And a case in point, today was at a DDA meeting. I am the chairman of the Downtown Development Authority. Okay. And we increase the contribution that we do to Hermanos de la Calle, which has, they have a, such a very effective program. They have gotten about 1,500 homeless off the street with a program. We increase the donation that we do to them or the contribution.
Right. And we should translate Hermanos de la Calle, brothers on the street.
Brothers on the street. Yeah. And they're doing a fantastic job. And I would recommend that everybody try to help them because mm-hmm. they really are being effective, not only taking the people out of the street, the homeless off the street temporarily, but they will house them. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they will stay in those houses forever, okay. all the time. But they have to work and they have to contribute to the what they're doing is trying to create again a sense of community and family mm-hmm. amongst them, and also right. they try to find if they have families or any relatives any place and try to family reunification. You see, I've been
No. Thank you very much for reminding us of that effort. That is important, Rebecca McGuire. Before the state legislature passed this new law, where did Broward County and its municipalities stand with regard to homeless persons sleeping or camping out in public spaces? Did any local governments already have laws in place, like Miami, that permitted law enforcement to remove homeless persons from those spaces?
So, sure. Some of our municipalities do have ordinances that are similar to what you've been talking about today. What we did very proactively and have been doing for the last year and a half is we've really increased our outreach efforts and gotten creative with some of our shelter provisions and really worked with our law enforcement. We are so lucky to have law enforcement that are that have an organization where all law enforcement municipalities come together and they are trained on street outreach and how to address and deal with homelessness and all the resources that are available. We make sure that our law enforcement are supported and they can offer a shelter instead of a jail as an alternative, so that we're not locking people up just for the mere fact that they're sleeping on the street or we're trespassing them because they have nowhere else to go. We've created specialized outreach teams, and to the same vein, areas where you homeless individuals tend to move towards, such as airports and bus terminals, we have created special outreach teams that are dedicated just to those areas. That work every single day in trying to engage people for anywhere from substance use treatment to housing to shelter to any other supportive services, right. case management from the street.
So
we've ramped that up within all of our municipalities.
So this week, Rebecca McGuire, you met with representatives of Broward County's 31 municipalities, correct?
That's correct.
Brainstorm how to address the situation before the October deadline, meaning October 1st when this new state law goes into effect. Okay. But I first wanted to ask you, Rebecca, what has been the response of Broward County and its local governments to the new state law and the Supreme Court ruling that permit banning homeless persons from sleeping in public spaces?
Well, our response has been that we've always taken the response that these are part of our community citizens, and they deserve to have a dignified and humane way to exist. So this legislation did not push us in a different direction. We're going to continue best practices. We're going to continue in what we do. We do not believe in setting up sanctioned encampments. We do not believe that is a humane way for people to be treated.
Right.
We're looking at increasing our shelter capacity.
But then what were some of the solutions or compromises that you and the Broward municipalities came up with to, as I said before, thread that needle between compliance with the new legal reality and compassion for the ongoing homelessness reality?
So this is our first of many meetings that we had on Monday, and this was an educational brainstorming session. What we did is we divided the municipalities into the South, the Central, and the North, and really what we wanted to do as the county is hear their ideas, their thoughts, their concerns. What are the biggest fears that we have here? And they actually came up with some incredible ideas that we're exploring as far as different ways to fund additional services. Where do we see the gaps in our services, and in what geographical areas of our county do we see the gaps that we need to shore up and we need to work on?
Okay.
What are they open to doing as far as, carrying the financial contribution? Because this is going to take resources.
Right.
When you're talking about increasing shelter beds and increasing permanent housing for individuals, that does come with a price tag. And so
right.
we are asking and looking at all avenues, including our Business Council on Homelessness, to help us step up and address these issues.
Okay.
So I think in the next few meetings, what we'll see is start looking at some locations. Where can we build capacity in what parts of the county to expand services and getting the municipalities on board with that?
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami City Commissioner Manolo Reyes and Rebecca McGuire of Broward County about how local government is responding to new state restrictions on the homeless population. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Commissioner Reyes, let me come back to you regarding the, as I said, ongoing homelessness reality. I know one of the reasons Miami in recent years has gone back to some of the pre-Pottinger regulations regarding homeless persons in public spaces is that there's an argument being made that Miami really doesn't have much of a homeless problem anymore, that Miami's homeless population did decline under the Pottinger agreement. But ironically, it has risen again since the city did away with Pottinger 5 years ago. So given that reality, how is Miami then?
Let me correct you. And there, today, I mean, we were talking to, I was talking to these people that are in the streets, which is Hermanos de la Calle, and they estimate that around the downtown and then the area that they are most homeless, there's around 400-500 homeless, which is quite a decrease on it, because and that's not only because of the police, it is because of the effort that has been made by institutions and the help that they have received from the city and the county and different governmental agencies in order to just not only take a man into a force them, but we cannot force them into one of those. We don't take them to Yale.
And as you said, you can't force them
We cannot force them, but we are providing as much needed services and support as they need, because we have to understand what is the problem, what the problem really is. The problem is really most of the homeless, the great majority, they are either addicts or they have mental issues.
Right.
We have to attack the problems by providing them with the proper support.
But Commissioner, as part of that proper support, are Miami and Miami-Dade County, for that matter, through entities like the Homeless Trust? But is Miami doing enough to create the kind of shelter capacity, for example, to handle the increase?
We don't have shelters. We don't have shelters. We don't have shelters. We work with agencies that they provide shelters, Lotus House, Camilo's House, and all of those places. And also other programs that they are like Hermano de la Calle, that they provide shelter also. But you ask a quick question, and Rebecca also mentioned something that in my opinion is quite important and has been my complaint to the state.
Right.
If the state is the state, they let the legislature that passed this law that requires the city to try to eliminate which I don't think that we'd be able to do it, because there are some people that they choose mm-hmm. that way of life.
Right.
But if they are going to place that mandate that we have to eliminate the people living in the streets and they have mm-hmm. to be in shelter, that has to come with a proper funds for us to be able to implement that law.
Okay.
And that is my complaint, and that's what I'm going to mm-hmm. go to Tallahassee and ask for.
Okay.
I remember that advertisement said, "Where's the meat?" You see?
Okay.
What are the funds that we need in order? In the city of Miami, we don't have shelters. When are we getting the funds to build the shelters?
Well, Commissioner, we wish you the best of luck with that effort in Tallahassee. Rebecca McGuire, I want to finish here with you and just step back and ask, if the new Florida state law banning homeless persons from sleeping in public spaces, does it really jive with the state's current reality? Are we just kidding ourselves as a state and a region in the sense that, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Miami has seen statistically an uptick in its homeless population. And according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Florida was one of five states last year that saw the highest percentage increase in its homeless population, largely because housing in Florida is so expensive and inaccessible. This problem is not going away. So does the new state law help or hurt then our ability to deal with that reality? Rebecca?
I think what the new state law does is start a conversation about resources that are needing to address this. I think there, you know, our homeless population is going up, but you look at what type of homeless population is going up. Is it the chronic homeless or is it our first time homeless? And it really is, we have our first time homeless numbers are going up. We've got families who can no longer afford to work and live in Broward County. So one of the answers that we look for is that we are going to have to increase affordable housing. If we want to have a workforce and we want to have people here who are not finding themselves after a year on the street and becoming chronically homeless, there's got to be prevention, has to be really the key to this.
Okay.
We also, you know,
Rebecca, I'm sorry. We're going to have to end it there for time. I apologize, but thank you very much. Rebecca McGuire is Broward County Strategic Housing and Innovation Officer. Manolo Reyes is Miami City Commissioner for District 4. Many thanks to you both.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
This week, another director of the Little Haiti Cultural Center resigned in apparent frustration with City of Miami oversight of this key Haitian community institution. The most immediate practical issue is long-needed repairs to the center complex, its roof, drainage, air conditioning. That situation led the city to issue unsafe structure citations last year, and last month to shut down the center's most popular attraction, the Caribbean Marketplace. But the larger question is whether the city has become indifferent to and neglectful of the Little Haiti Cultural Center. Those concerns are heightened by encroaching gentrification and development in Little Haiti. City officials insist they want the cultural center to remain open and thrive. Others say the problem is lack of communication. Either way, the future of this Haitian community icon right now feels uncertain to the Haitian community. Do you feel the City of Miami is taking the Little Haiti Cultural Center seriously enough? How can the center's directors improve the situation? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We had hoped to talk to Kenyatta Warren, the Little Haiti Cultural Center director who resigned this week, but he declined to join us. We are joined by Warren's two predecessors, former Little Haiti Cultural Center directors Abraham Metellus and Sandy Dorsonville. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Abe Metellus, although Kenyatta Warren declined to join us, can you summarize for us why he resigned this week as the Little Haiti Cultural Center's director? What were his key frustrations?
I think you hit it on the nail. I think there are a lot of concerns that have been bubbling, even during my tenure there from 2016 to 2019. The city has a great opportunity to help galvanize the center with resources, but it seems like every time we are communicating the needs of the community, because as a cultural center manager, you function as a de facto liaison between what the community wants and your department. So as the community brings up concerns about wanting to see additional programming or their concerns about the building, we as former managers have brought these concerns to the city, but then it becomes the same rhetoric as far as like budget and money and resources and delays. And so having been through it and now seeing it happen to another manager, there just seems to be a systemic issue, a targeting of not really wanting to see the Little Haiti Cultural Center thrive.
Sandy Dorsonville, do you agree? What do you feel were the key issues that prompted Kenyatta Warren to resign?
I agree with Abraham. He was very frustrated, and as we all were, with not having the backup that he needed to make things happen. He was a very strong personality, very efficient person, and he was used to, and has a military background, so he was used to making things happen. So he was just very frustrated, as we all have been, with not being able to move the needle forward.
Let's step back for a second and remind people why the Little Haiti Cultural Center is such an important institution, not just for Miami's robust Haitian community, but for the Miami community in general. I mean, its appeal is not just to Haitians, right, Abe?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a place that, you know, this is the vision of the late Arthur Teal. He wanted a space where the Haitian and Afro-Caribbean community can have a wonderful theater, gallery, courtyard, and their marketplace that would promote and preserve our culture. And so, I mean, we're talking about a place that has at least 100,000 visitors a year. And so it's really important. And that is why in 2017, we got the Caribbean Marketplace designated as a historical landmark because of its significance in the community.
And remind me, is that very beautiful facade of the center, remind me, does that harken back to what I think architectural experts call the sort of gingerbread house architecture of historic Haiti?
Absolutely. It was supposed to remind folks of the Marché aux Enchères in Haiti. And so this is during my tenure there from 2016 to 2019, we had an opportunity to at least program it somewhat. But again, we were always met with resistance from the department. Well, but the thing is that we've in order to address this, because we, from what we've heard in the last meeting, the marketplace will be closed in the next 2 years. And so one of the ways that we're meeting that need and closing the gap is that Sandy and I have opened up a visitor center in Little Haiti that's down the street to help address some of these needs.
So I just want to clarify that. The Caribbean marketplace will be closed for the next 2 years?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. All right. Sandy, I just wanted to ask you as well, why do you feel that the Little Haiti Cultural Center is such an important institution, not just for the Haitian community, but for Miami in general?
The Haitian community is the second largest immigrant group in South Florida, and we are very much part of the fabric that makes South Florida this unique, beautiful, vibrant place. And this is where the Little Haiti Cultural Center, the marketplace, this is where people come to learn about us. This is where tourists come to learn about us, and this is where South Floridians come to share and exchange their creative juices, for lack of a better word of saying it. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that this space is vibrant and is transparent and is full of activity so that people can come there and meet and learn. And it just makes Miami just a little bit more palatable and more enjoyable for everyone who's coming through, and not just the Hispanic culture or the African-American
right.
culture.
Very much part of what makes us such a cosmopolitan city, no?
Correct.
Right. Well, then let me ask you both then, what do you both feel the city of Miami needs to do to show that it takes the Little Haiti Cultural Center and its future more seriously, especially in the context we just discussed? Abe?
I think just accountability. I think and following up. I know a lot of times we're comparing Little Haiti to different neighborhoods, but I think one of the strengths of those neighborhoods is that they consistently follow up. And so via through emails and showing up to the meetings, we're trying to keep the city accountable. Again, the rhetoric seems to be the same from the city, but now having, you know, two former managers and seeing the current manager being yeah. discouraged out of this position, we're going to keep asking the questions. We're going to demand an email like, yo, we need to know when the repairs are going to be done. We need to know, what are you going to do in the interim as far as like the next cultural manager, and how are you going to provide right. A streamlined supportive system for the next person that takes that helm?
Yep.
But again, in response to that, we've opened up a new place called Shoe Block Garden in Little Haiti to at least meet the needs for tourism and culture.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Sandy, what do you think the city needs to do to show more concern?
They follow through. follow through. They have the resources. They have the wherewithal. They and they have staff at the cultural center that's willing to do the work and that love this space. Mm-hmm. So just following through, putting their money and their resources where their mouth is, and making sure to provide the staff, a uh-huh. full-time staff that the space needs, okay. Because that's also what the space is lacking. Right. And also to support the surrounding community, the new businesses that are opening, the new art galleries, the new spaces that are now available to the community, helping to promote those and market those to our communities as well.
Okay. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Abraham Metellus and Sandy Dorsenville, two former directors of the Little Haiti Cultural Center, about the uncertain future of that Miami community icon. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Let's pivot a little here, though, and consider the city of Miami side of things, as I've been hearing them. City officials like Chris Evans of the Parks Department, as I mentioned earlier, they insist they want to see the Little Haiti Cultural Center survive and thrive. But they also say they need better communication and responsiveness from the center's leadership, from directors like you and Kenyatta Warren. Last year, for example, some of those officials claimed they were surprised to hear of the structural problems that led to those safety citations I mentioned. What can be done to improve communication between the center, the city, and the entity the city relies on to oversee things in this regard, the Little Haiti Revitalization Trust? Abe, let me start with you.
You know what? I would say that the communication has been present. I think that based off of, you know, my experience, there's been nothing more than over communication. I think what it is that what ends up happening is that the city ends up like dragging its feet. It drags its feet. And the thing is, until someone becomes that squeaky wheel to get things moving, the city will not move. And so I think there has been communication. I think there's a plethora of emails and text messages. I mean, you have City of Miami officials that have attended the cultural center and experienced the heat in the theater, and then want to pretend as if like they didn't know anything was going on. Mm. Concerns have been made, emails have been sent, but they've been ignored. And so I think the language that comes from the city of Miami, as far as like they didn't hear or they didn't know of anything, I think it's a lie. And I think we need to continue to follow up and keep them accountable, because I know from my experience, from Sandy's experience, from Rasha's experience, from Anita Darbone's experience, and even Mr. Warren's experience, that we have communicated. And then here's my thing. How can you say that in the meeting that under Kenyatta's leadership, that all these programs were successful and they were thriving, but yet you want to, but yet you're not also bringing up the fact that he has communicated the issues about the cultural center.
Abe, I want to end things here with a call that we have now on the line from Haitian community leader Gypsy Metellus. Gypsy, many thanks for calling in. What are your concerns here?
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you to Abe and to Sandy for representing not just the perspective of two former.
And Gypsy, we only have about 30 seconds left here.
So I am in complete agreement that the city of Miami is actually showing much disrespect and much neglect for the Haitian community, right? And I want to remind them that there is a standing covenant between the city and the members of the community who fought for the passage of the bond program that created these.
Okay. Gypsy, unfortunately, I apologize. We have run out of time. I wish we could talk a little more. I apologize. We will have to end it there. Abraham Metellus and Sandy Dorsenville are former directors of the Little Haiti Cultural Center. Many thanks to you both. Finally on the roundup, Copa Mania. The That's Argentine fans at the Miami Beach Bandshell Tuesday night after Lionel Messi and the Argentine national soccer team beat Canada to advance to the final of the Copa America. They'll take on James Rodriguez and Colombia in the Hemispheric Soccer Tournament's championship game, which will be played here in Miami at Hard Rock Stadium on Sunday night at 8 p.m. Get ready for a sea of Argentine albiceleste, or blue and white jerseys, the Vueltetiao sombreros of Colombia, and the best soccer in the Americas. What we don't want here, however, is a repeat of the slugfest in the stands that broke out between Colombian and Uruguayan fans and players at the end of their semifinal match in Charlotte, North Carolina, Wednesday night. The Copa America final is a dress rehearsal for the 7 World Cup soccer games Miami will host 2 years from now. Entonces, nada de peleas, por favor. No fights. Let's end the Copa right on our pitch. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.